News, weather, traffic, money, politics, big interviews, and bold opinions. It's what's happening right now. This is Mornings with Simi.
Well, the focus has certainly shifted in Texas over the last 24 hours after that horrific mass shooting that left 19 children and two adults dead in Uvalde, Texas. Now, we know that there's a lot of questions about the police behavior as that whole thing unfolded. So let's go now to Reggie Giacchini, our Global Washington correspondent, who is in Texas reporting on this story. Good morning, Reggie.
Good morning.
So that was there were a couple of police press conferences yesterday, Reggie, which I thought were really interesting because all of a sudden we're getting contradictions about what we were told when it first happened versus a couple of days later now.
Yeah, and it really is raising questions to what could have been done differently or better to prevent a lot of the carnage that played out on Tuesday. And you're right, there is conflicting information that is being given to the media and is being given to families who are simply looking for a sense of closure here. And ultimately, the answer that we don't have, or at least the answer that we're looking for right now, is why is there more than an hour, roughly an hour and 10 minutes of unaccounted for police time? Well, this gunman, the suspected gunman, was barricaded inside of a classroom. Parents are furious that they weren't allowed to be entering the school, that they were being held back by police, even while police weren't doing anything inside the school. There's a lot that is unknown right now, and it is just adding to the agony that these parents are going through.
Yeah, that must have been very confusing and really awful for them yesterday to hear this press conference where they're kind of changing their story about what happened as the situation unfolded, where at first they said an officer had exchanged gunfire with this person as he was entering the school. Now it turns out none of that happened.
Yeah, that there was no confrontation of this suspect. And I mean, it's even contradictory to the accounts that we're getting from these little kids that were inside the classroom and the details that they're giving out that are not being given out by police. When we hear 8 and 9 year olds talking about how they could see the bullets on the floor of the classroom, so they understood that the situation was real. I mean, something the kids just should not understand. Yet the police weren't there to help them. There was another little girl who said that she assumed that the police were on their way to help her. And then she started to cry when she found out that they were actually outside the classroom and not coming in to help her. So, I mean, the emotions are real and they're raw here. And police aren't doing the community any favors by not being upfront or at least clear. The only clarity that police provided yesterday was, well, we're a small town. So it can take time for things to get done. And it's a response that's just not flying well with a lot of the residents here.
Oh, I can imagine that for sure. So one of the reasons that they were giving for standing out there was because they were waiting for SWAT to go in, the SWAT team to show up and go in. But so many parents are pointing out, like, you're talking about a lot of heavily armed police officers who were standing outside. Are there any investigations that are going to go on, Reggie, in terms of trying to find out what really happened?
Yeah, and I mean, look, there's a Texas representative, Joaquin Castro, who's actually drafted a letter to the FBI for the FBI to open up an investigation into the people who were supposed to be taking care of this crisis. There was a retired police officer from Illinois who said that in any situation like this, officers should be entering a building and movement number one should be targeting the suspect, taking the suspect down to stop the situation from going forward, and that police departments train for this. There's new documents that have been released that show that this police department recently trained for this kind of an event. And it begs more questions as to what went wrong here. If they were simply in the school, near the school, around the school, what was barricading this door so much that they couldn't enter a classroom when a person with a gun was able to simply just walk in? Yeah. Why weren't police able to? These are the questions being asked.
No kidding. I also heard that they were, one of the officers in the press conference said they were waiting for a key for the door. And I thought, well, that really seems like something. Okay, the other story here is the fact that the NRA convention is going ahead in Texas just days after this horrible shooting. Has anybody backed out, or like, who's still scheduled to speak at this?
Yeah, look, this is going forward. Even the mayor of Houston said it shouldn't be going forward, but it's been planned. It's been planned since pre-pandemic times. It's hard to simply just stop something from going forward like this. The planned attendees, former President Donald Trump, will be headlining this event. Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who has bankrolled hundreds of thousands of dollars from gun rights groups, including the NRA, over his career, will be speaking. Who won't be there? Texas Governor Greg Abbott. He was supposed to attend. He instead will send a video message. He is going to come to Uvalde, Texas today. But still, there is anger from the residents here saying, why was that even something on your agenda? Was this just crocodile tears that we saw earlier in the week as you were planning to go to this NRA convention? One person not going, though, Simi, is Texas Senator Ted Cornyn. Texas Senator Cornyn, John Cornyn gets a 100% rating from the NRA. He instead is meeting with Democrats to discuss gun rights legislation.
Okay, that's interesting. Is Ted Cruz still scheduled to go?
Ted Cruz is still scheduled to go. This is something that fits into the kind of agenda for Ted Cruz. This fits into his political background. He has made a lot of money to his campaigns via the NRA, and he is a staunch Second Amendment supporter. So he will be speaking there. And remember, this is a senator who has actively pushed that this was not a gun related issue, that this was a mental health crisis that caused this this shooting on Tuesday. So, you know, again, anger pouring out over Ted Cruz's decision to keep going to this.
I'm sure there's more to come. Reggie, thank you.
Thank you.
It's Reggie Jacchini, our global Washington correspondent, who is actually right now in Uvalde, Texas, covering this story. And it has been really interesting to watch how this story has kind of changed over the last few days. You know, typically after mass shootings, and sadly, we know how this works, right? When we have one of these in the United States, they typically follow a pattern of, oh, now we talk about gun control, now nothing happens, then everything goes back to normal until there's another shooting. That's not really happening with this one, because yes, there's the gun control discussion, but also there's a lot of questioning about how this unfolded and the role of police in it, and that discussion is not going away.
This is Mornings with Simi.
What would help us deal with our real estate market? There's a lot of different levers that can be pulled here, but you know, I know what most people are going to say is just something to get us lower prices. Well, it's easier said than done. What are some of the other things that can be done, though? What about finding a way to make the buying process easier, perhaps more fair, with things like a cooling off period? Well, that's one of the things that has now been recommended by a regulator for BC's real estate sector. And we're going to talk more about that now with the help of our guest. Blair Morrison is the CEO of the BC Financial Services Authority. Blair, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. So first of all, tell me about the work that the BC Financial Services Authority does.
So we are the integrated regulator for the financial services sector here in BC, Simi, and that's quite a broad sector that covers everything from credit unions to trust companies to insurance companies to real estate, licensees, and mortgage brokers, and also pensions. This sector, as you can imagine, is really important for the overall prosperity of the province itself. But it is also very important for individual British Columbians, the most important decisions that they make in their lives. Will I retire if I have a pension? Will the pension be able to support me? Where do I deposit my money? Do I use a credit union? If I'm going to de-risk a situation, will my insurance cover it? And for the topic today, obviously, the buying and selling of a home, the biggest financial decision most of us will make.
Right. And so what made the BC Financial Services Authority decide it was time to take a look at the buying process of a home?
So that's a great question. I'll give you some context and take you back to November of last year, so November 2021. At that time, the BC Minister of Finance announced the government's intention to put in a cooling off period for resale and newly built home sales. Now, what a cooling off period means is after you have a signed deal, you have a period of time as the buyer to rescind, to get out of the deal. Cooling off periods are common in other industries. You've seen them in gym memberships. For those of you who remember door-to-door salespeople, you know, those are there as well. But this was the first discussion of it in a real estate context. The minister also asked us at that time to go out and consult and talk about with experts what the parameters of that cooling off period should be. And she also asked us to look at some additional measures to address risks associated with unconditional offers and alternatives to the blind bidding process.
Okay.
And I know we're going to get into details, but I just wanted to highlight the point you made up front. This was a focus on consumer protection. You know, the housing affordability issue is important. We understand, we empathize, we want to be part of that solution. But this work related to the government's direction to us on consumer protection.
Okay, so starting with, I think, the one that's getting the most attention here is this idea of a cooling off period. How do you envision that working?
Yeah, so again, the government made a policy decision in the fall of last year to implement one, and it actually passed amendments to the Property Act in April this year to put it into place. Now, the putting into place, you know, was waiting for the advice that we were giving them on it. What we have said to the minister is a whole suite of protections that deal with the various stages of a real estate transaction. With respect to the cooling off period, we are proposing 3 clear business days in order for someone to invoke a cooling off or a termination. It should be non-waivable. We don't want this to be a negotiation point between buyers and sellers. There will be limited exemptions that we suggest the government put into place, things like court-ordered sales. And we've also added an advice related to a modest termination fee. And again, you know, one thing we heard during the consultations was, oh, this is just going to encourage frivolous offers. So we do need something that sort of balances that. And part of that balance is a modest termination fee.
Okay. So what do you classify as a modest termination fee?
Somewhere between 0.1 and 0.5. So on a $1 million house, you know, somewhere between $1,000 to $5,000.
Okay, so you feel like that would be enough for people to say, listen, we can and we should get out of this deal.
Yeah, so let me take a step back. So I said it's part of a larger suite. So in addition to the cooling off period, what our advice includes to government is a pre-offer period. And that's a period where once you've listed your home, you need 5 clear days before you can accept any offer. Now, what we've heard and what the government's heard is buyers under a lot of pressure, and there's things called bully offers where people come in immediately, and before they even the open house comes, they come in with a significant offer. Again, we're trying to make the process less stressful, more manageable, more transparent for buyers. So during that 5-day period, if it's open, people can do due diligence, people can check the property if it's available. Again, ultimately, if you're the winner, if you have an agreement of purchase and sale, you'll still have those 2 days to reflect, maybe do some more due diligence, maybe do a home inspection if you haven't had a chance, confirm your financing, and then do the sale.
Right.
And the last thing we've advised is increased disclosure. We believe transparency about the product, about the property is important, and we've encouraged increased disclosure throughout that process.
Do you think these measures kind of level the playing field?
Yeah, I mean, we think we stand by the advice, and we see it as good, basic, fundamental protections that consumers should have. We heard a lot about this heated market and what happens in a cooling market, what happens in different regions of British Columbia. But we think this is fundamental. We think this is good, basic protections that consumers should have. A regulator's job is to try to put confidence in the market. We want to ensure confidence. And I think by ensuring confidence, by having a market where consumers are protected, where we have increased transparency, that's going to increase confidence in the market.
Okay, so do you foresee these being taken, put into place then? Is this what is going to be the new reality?
So the report is advice to the government, and they received the report this week as we published it to the public. So fundamentally, it's over to the government. They have moved forward on cooling off, but we've given them a lot of things to consider. It's an 80-page report, lots of details. So we've asked the government to obviously consider it and then decide on next steps. Implementation will be, will be a focus. We're going to have to deal with real estate licensees, the lawyers who deal with the scenario, the people involved in the process. But whatever the advice the government comes with, the most important thing will be making sure members of the public understand what these new rights mean.
Right. Now, Blair, do other jurisdictions do this? Were there other areas that you took some advice from?
In terms of the mandatory pre-offer period and the cooling off period, in the real estate context, no. The minister did ask us to look at blind bidding, which I know you and your listeners have heard a lot about in terms of the process.
Yes.
And we didn't advise directly on that, but what we did provide advice to the minister is an English style of auction. Those are those situations where you've seen the video where the realtor in Australia is on the corner of the street and everybody's friendly bidding. We're not recommending that, but there is a model that's in Scandinavian countries, which is a little bit of a modification of that, which has a concept of open bidding, but it also has a concept of negotiating the contract at the same time. Again, these are unique and big changes to a process that's been in place for 10, 50, 100 years. So we want to make sure we implement it. So on blind bidding, we've asked the government, our advice is to take a step back, consider the model in Scandinavia, and consider whether or not in discussions and conversations with the sector as to whether or not it could apply here in BC.
Okay, and what is significant about that model in Scandinavia?
Again, there's an open bidding. You will know what the other person is bidding against the house.
Okay, that would definitely be, I think a lot of people would probably welcome that. So we'll see if it happens. Blair, thank you for explaining it all to us this morning.
Okay, thank you so much. Have a great day, everyone.
You too. That's Blair Morrison, CEO of the BC Financial Services Authority, talking about their recommendations in a report that they have now given to the Finance Minister, Selena Robinson, and we'll see if the government takes the steps that are recommended in this. But that issue, the blind bidding one, is really interesting too, right? Just open bid so that you know what everybody else has bid. What is the offer that that person put in on that house? You know, so you can then, you know, make your offer correspondingly. That means that you don't have to offer several $100,000 above asking price for fear that that's what the other person did. You would know what that person had offered. Do you like that idea? Let me know. Simi@cknw.com.
This is Mornings with Simi.
Let's talk about riding transit. We heard this week that the recovery of ridership has actually been doing pretty well when you compare it to other North American cities, particularly for riding the bus. According to TransLink, ridership has rebounded to about 70% of pre-pandemic levels. Now, that's still 70%. That means that there's still some people missing, right? But what is it that's being done here that is different from being done elsewhere that makes more people getting back on transit? Well, let's talk more about that. Joining us now is Jonathan Cote, chair of the TransLink Mayor's Council and a member of the TransLink Board. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show, and good morning.
So what is it that's being done here is that is so different that is making transit kind of rebound better?
Yeah, well, you know what, I think it has to do with some of the successes we were having before the pandemic, where we were leading Canada, the U.S. in record ridership in the region. I think Metro Vancouver really is becoming more and more of a public transit type of city that supports that. And I think there's a lot of factors that's involved in some actually really good investments in our public transit system over the past decade. But also, we've seen a lot of growth in the region, and a lot of that growth is actually concentrated in areas that is well served by transit. And I think that just naturally makes a region like Metro Vancouver, I think, better positioned to recover for the pandemic.
Right. Looking at those numbers specifically, though, it was bus ridership that has done particularly well, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, and I think we when we think of transit, we often think of the, you know, kind of the big exciting projects like SkyTrain, which is obviously really important to our system. But the reality is our bus network in Metro Vancouver is the backbone of our transit system. And I think what we've seen through the pandemic and people still relying heavily on the importance of our bus network really does highlight that this is a part of our transit system that doesn't get as much attention, but actually really is kind of the workhorse in our system.
Okay, so what does that tell us? So how do we get those numbers even higher?
Well, you know what? I think we're seeing life coming back to the system, and every month, over the past 6 months, seems to be even more positive news there. So, I think we continue to work through that there. I think the big question where ridership still remains a little bit weak is kind of your office work, particularly downtown Vancouver, has not recovered like other areas of our transit system, and a lot of that depends on how much are people going to be coming back to the office, and that that still remains to be seen. But I think we're seeing more and more workplaces, even if it's only, you know, 2 or 3 days a week, starting to come back, and that's, you know, only going to help transit ridership grow in the region.
Now, I understand as well that the Mayor's Council has approved the new investment plan. Is that right?
Yeah, yesterday the Mayor's Council unanimously passed an investment plan, and this was actually a really important plan that, you know, we've had a difficult couple of years with the pandemic, but what this plan does is actually provide financial sustainability TransLink over the next 3 years, and allows us to be able to actually commit to stable transit service. So even though we've found a very difficult financial time, this has actually provided at least 3 years of financial stability to the region, which I think is critically important as we try and recover and come out of the pandemic.
Yeah, what is the financial hit right now to TransLink? I mean, if not as many people are on transit, there must be a financial hit that's been taken.
Yeah, well, you know, transit fare revenue is a significant component of the operating revenue, almost you know, before the pandemic, almost 50%. So, no doubt it does have an impact. But we've been really fortunate to have the support both of the provincial and federal government that have helped transit agencies all across BC and across Canada help be able to weather that storm there. And I think, you know, As ridership grows, you know, we're only going to improve that situation there. But no doubt it has an impact, and it continues to have an impact today.
Okay, so in what ways then is TransLink dealing with that funding gap?
Well, you know, what we've done with our investment plan, as I mentioned, is we've kind of provided some financial sustainability and stabilization over the next 3 years. So with that, obviously, we have received support provincially and federally to help us there. But we also did approve a small 1% escalator on the property tax to basically help shore up the finances of TransLink and get us through this period and hopefully get us completely through the pandemic.
Okay, so is that temporary or is that permanent?
You know, that tax is part of the base tax, so you know that it'll be an extra $3 a year that's added next in 2023. Now that $3 will obviously stay in place moving forward to provide the sustainability for the system.
Okay, so if people are wondering why that went up, this is the reason why that went up.
Yeah, but having said that, I would say, you know, when people look at their property tax bill, you know, I think a $3 increase on average across the region is, in my opinion, pretty reasonable for being able to provide stabilization for our important public transit system in Metro Vancouver.
Okay, so given that we know that people are clearly riding the bus right now in increasing numbers more so than perhaps other modes of transit, how does that influence the decision making then? What kind of impact does that have on planning for more bus service?
Yeah, well, you know, recently the Mayor's Council has put out, you know, our vision for the 10 years priority in the region, and it still includes, you know, major projects like SkyTrain expansion to UBC, but there's a real heavy focus on improving bus service in the region, a lot more so than we've seen in past plans, and I think that's a real recognition from the Mayor's Council, the importance that our bus system plays, and the fact that buses, you know, improving bus system can actually be a far more cost-effective way to improve public transit in our region. So we're talking about all the way from regular bus service being improved, but also talking about bus rapid transit being introduced in our region as a real cost-effective way to more effectively get people, you know, back onto transit, but in a more affordable way.
Okay, so it sounds like there's a lot of work that's being done here. So, Mayor Côté, where will people, do you think, notice a difference in the next year or two?
Well, you know, I think in the next few years, you know, I think it's just having the confidence that our transit system is going to be able to be stable and deliver the good transit service that we currently provide the region. You know, I think we're one of the few regions in Canada and the United States that actually has funding certainty over the next 3 years, given the difficulties we've had. And I think that's really important, knowing that people that rely on public transit, that service is going to be there to continue. There are a couple of additions. The investment plan does allow the SkyTrain expansion to Langley, which we have talked about years, to finally be a fully funded project. And we also know our region is very committed to climate change. So this investment plan also does provide some funding to help us shift to electric buses. So there's not going to be dramatic changes in the next few years. It's more about stabilization. But there are a few positive things that are also important to highlight in this plan.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Well, really appreciate the opportunity to chat this morning.
That's Jonathan Cote, chair of the TransLink Mayor's Council, member of the TransLink Board, talking about the plans that they have approved and also the struggle that has been the case for, you know, transportation authorities right across North America is how to deal with people no longer riding transit because of the pandemic, and they're very slow to come back. So ridership on the bus system has rebounded to 70% of pre-pandemic levels, and that is a huge improvement. In fact, it's a better recovery rate than cities like Toronto, Montreal, Washington, Chicago, and even San Francisco. But challenges remain. SkyTrain, CBus, those levels are below what they were, still significantly below what they were pre-pandemic. How do you get people back on transit? Talk to me about that. Or have you given up riding transit? Are you thinking about going back to it? Did your habits change during the pandemic? Simi at cknw.com.
This is Mornings with Simi.
You know, so many people have been waiting to start traveling again post-pandemic. And now that they are, what are they faced with? Huge lineups at Canadian airports. And it's gotten so bad that groups are calling on the government to step in and do something. Now you've got a group that represents a lot of the world's airlines telling the Canadian government, hey, listen, you need to drop some of these travel rules related to COVID-19. We've got to do something to reduce the delays that people are facing at Canadian airports. So joining us now is Peter Serta. Peter is the Regional Vice President of the Americas for the International Air Transport Association. Peter, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Good morning to everyone.
Is Canada the only country that is facing these kinds of delays at airports?
Well, we are seeing some disruptions around the world as countries reopen and we have more people traveling. But Canada really is the exception in terms of the numbers of passengers that are being negatively impacted almost on a weekly basis. Over the last several weeks, you know, over 100,000 passengers have experience some sort of disruption coming into the country through immigrations or trying to get on airplanes going through security. So it is becoming a problem, considering that we have the summer season just around the corner. And as we know, Canadians love to travel, and many foreigners take advantage of the great weather in Canada to come and visit many places like Vancouver, Montreal, Toronto during the summer. So, and that's our concern. The summer season will get much worse if the government doesn't take immediate action on the matter.
Okay, so what is the concern here? What is causing these delays?
Well, one of the key factor here is the immigration halls or the security lines are just very, very long. And in the case when you're arriving into the country, because these arrival halls are saturated, passengers are being left on board airplanes, and they're being left on board airplanes anywhere from 25 minutes to 2 to 3 hours. So you can imagine if you're flying in from Seattle into Vancouver, which is roughly a 35-minute flight, your flight is actually less than the amount of time you may be holding on an airplane just to get off and to get into Vancouver. And the primary issue here is not enough staffing. There's not enough security staffing. There's not enough immigration staffing, particularly with all the protocols that are in place today.
Okay, so that's right across the board then? Is it short-staffed just at major airports right across the country?
Yeah, we are seeing the biggest concern right now, the biggest backlog of passengers is in Toronto. The recovery in Toronto has been very quick. You know, a lot of people are coming into the main airport of the country. We are seeing, however, Montreal, Vancouver is also experiencing long wait times. And in the case of Vancouver, as Asian markets begin to open and more Asians begin to fly, particularly to Vancouver, the situation is just going to get worse in Vancouver as well.
Okay, so is it being addressed, Peter? Like, what do we know about that?
Well, we have written to the government of Canada. We've written to different ministries seeking their help. We know that hiring more staff is a challenge. The workforce is now at a critical stage, and it will take time to train the new security and immigration officers. But there are steps that can be taken in the short term. Many passengers that do come into Canada, for example, all passengers have to do a declaration. They have to use an app that's called ArriveCan. Many passengers do it correctly, but others don't. And that's the problem, where a passenger, if the application is done correctly, it's 15 to 30 seconds to be approved. If it's done incorrectly, well, it could take anywhere between 5 and 10 minutes. So what we're asking one aspect that the government can do is separate those passengers. Passengers that have done it correctly, let them flow, let them go quickly through the process. And those that have not, well, you create another line for that. But right now, you're mixing everyone in the same line. And that's why we're having the backlog. Also, a lot of the information that immigration officers are being asked to ask on arrivals, those type of questions should be, again, requested before the passenger even arrives to the country. So they can use the application, again, to take a lot of that work that has to be done on the ground and do it before the passenger can leave. So short term, those are some of the areas that we can have quick fix. And then the other aspect is hiring more officers to man the stations.
You know what? You're so right about that, though. Like, you've trained all these travelers to use that Arrive Can app. You can adapt it to take some of the lineups away from what's happening. But the government seems very slow to respond here. What has been the response then to your calls for this?
Well, unfortunately, it has been slow. And this has been one of the challenges that we as an industry have faced in Canada during the whole pandemic. The government has taken a very conservative approach, has not really worked with the industry very openly, very collaboratively. And it's really been an uphill battle. And while the government has taken some proactive steps over the last several months to reopen the country to foreigners and travel and tourism to come back, there is a lot that still needs to be done. And the summer is an opportunity for the country to recover. Many Canadians have been locked down for 2 years. They have not seen their family members. They have not been able to take a vacation, and they want to travel. And the same with passengers wanting to go to Canada, either for personal or for vacation. But if we do not fix the problem now, it's going to be a very difficult and tough summer. And who's going to be negatively impacted are the consumers, are the travelers who are going to be very frustrated coming into the country or trying to get onto an airplane.
All right. Well, Peter, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Peter Serda is the Regional Vice President for the Americas of the International Air Transport Association. So they represent a whole bunch, in fact, most of the world's airlines. And they're saying, hey, Canada, get your stuff together and do something about these long lineups, particularly at Pearson, but it's happening right across the country. Vancouver, Montreal, same thing. But people are facing these unreasonable delays for getting processed, whether it's security or through customs, but they're short-staffed. And they're trying to ramp up, but they're still short hundreds and hundreds of employees from pre-pandemic levels. But the thing is, you know, Peter just offered up some great suggestions. This is the frustrating thing about government. We've seen this with the passport situation, too, is that there are ways to make the system more efficient, whereas even if you're short-staffed, you can still process people faster. You've got all these people trained to use Arrive Can. Add a few questions to Arrive Can, the people who do it correctly, who get their code, and they can just show it, and boom, they're gone through. They don't have to wait and still get asked questions. I mean, there's ways to improve the situation. What is the government going to do about it? If you want to weigh in, simi@cknw.com. But boy, is that a frustrating situation. And here we are heading to a very busy summer travel season.